Okay. So, last time we laid out the broad contours of what a theory of history is meant to be and what the core intuitions were that underlay this grand attempt at producing very ambitiously a theory of human history that is sufficiently abstract as to encompass the totality of human history from its ancient misty origins through the present into the future. So that has to be very abstract. It can't be a fine-grained account if it is to be a theory of such a encompassing trajectory of change. It needs to be abstract and yet coherent. It needs to have some content. It can't be a pure meta theory. It can't be just a philosophy of history. It needs to be the attempt is a real scientific account. The core underlying intuition is that in order for there to be a theory of history of that scale, there must be something in the human experience and human social life that could give history some directionality so that you can organize your theoretical arguments in a way that has a developmental trajectory to it. In cosmology, there's clear directionality to the fate of the universe after the Big Bang. In the growth of an organism, there's clear directionality in terms of the differentiation of cells and the maturing of cells and so on. We can develop an account that is not just comparative statics. You know, what's the difference in the appearance of an adult and an embryo? But we can say the adult is a matured form of the earlier form. You can actually give direction to it. Well, the intuition is that it's the forces of production, the development of our capacity to transform nature, that has a clear directionality to it. And underlying that, descriptive observation is a slightly deeper interpretation, which says it's knowledge about how to transform nature. That's really what has this cumulative directional character to it. That's the first part of the intuition. Knowledge develops. It gets passed on from generation to generation. Except under very special circumstances, it isn't lost. Now, strictly speaking, the theory doesn't insist that knowledge can't be lost any more than evolutionary biology insists that you couldn't have a comet that destroys the Earth. Of course, there could be contingent historical events which result in knowledge being lost. In the development of human history, there are episodes where knowledge is lost. It's often noted how much knowledge was lost during the early medieval period in Europe after the collapse of the Roman Empire. There was a great deal of knowledge about architecture, about agriculture. It was actually lost, not passed on from one generation to the next. And part of the problem of the early medieval period was the loss of human capacity to transform nature, and thus a decline of productivity, not an advance of productivity. But in general, knowledge isn't lost. So that gives us directionality. The second intuition is that there's some kind of systematic rather than just random connection between the ways we live our lives socially, the rules which govern our access to resources, the nature of our culture, the forms of relationships and hierarchy and inequalities, all these things which are the stuff of social life, social relations. There's some kind of non-random connection between those forms and the development of the forces of production. Now, if there was no necessary connection, if it was really, you could have any kind of social relations regardless of the forces of production, then the intuition that the forces of production develop over time would not be sufficient to give you a theory of history, because the theory of history that we care about is the theory of our social relationships, of the nature of the societies in which we live. And if there's no connection between the nature of the societies in which we live and the underlying material conditions of transforming nature, if there's no connection between these two, even if there's directionality to the force of production, that would not be enough to give us any kind of directionality or sequencing or trajectory to the social relations. Well, that's the big task. How do you connect these two things? How do you anchor an account of changes in social structures, relations, institutions to an account of the development of the forces of production? The Marxian way of doing this is not the only way of doing it. It's a standard idea in social and sociology that there's a progression of societies that goes from hunting and gathering societies to what then is typically called agrarian societies, to industrial societies, to post-industrial societies. Now, that way of talking about it, note, names the kind of society by its technology. Right, so that's a very limited extension from the forces of production to the society that uses those forces of production. To say, with the most primitive of technologies, you have hunting and gathering, and once you get the development of knowledge of agriculture, you get agrarian societies, and once that develops into the harnessing of energy for larger scale production, you get industrial society. Well, the name of the type of society is essentially the name of the forces of production of that society. That's a pretty limited extension. You know, you're basically doing almost nothing more than saying, once again, just with slightly different terms, that the forces of production themselves have a progression, have a sequence. If you name the kind of society just by relabeling the forces of production and calling it, making it an adjective for society. What Marx and the Marxist tradition tries to do is to give social names to the forms of society that connect to the forces of production. So instead of hunting and gathering, it's called primitive communism. Very different way of describing those early societies. It's not describing them by the way they make their living, it's describing them by the social relations themselves. It's called primitive communism. I think if we were developing these categories anew, the word primitive wouldn't have been used. You know, that is a 19th century way of thinking about this. One might have called it something like simple communalism or something like that, or undifferentiated communalism. There'd be some term that didn't have that normative cultural expression tied to it. But in any case, Marx called it primitive communism. Instead of calling the next type of society agrarian, the standard Marxian term is to say you get feudal societies and other forms of non-capitalist class societies. Cohen wants to simply say non-capitalist class societies is the second stage. The non-capitalist class societies are all agrarian societies. It's true that all of these societies that are class societies, but non-capitalist, organize social production around agriculture and the extraction of surplus from agriculture. And they solve the problem of how to extract surplus from the people who actually do the work in different ways. But none of those ways are capitalist. And instead of industrial society, the Marxian term is capitalism. Now, capitalism is a way more ambitious way of talking about the form of social relations and structures that get connected to industry than to simply say industrial society. I mean, I think this is pretty obvious. That's why the Marxian account is such an ambitious one. So I think I'm belaboring this point, and sometimes it's a good thing to belabor points, and other times it just gets repetitive. So maybe I've crossed the threshold, and now I'm just getting repetitive. I just want to really appreciate how ambitious it is to try to say there is an orderly sequence to the development of forms of society. It's not random. If you ran the tape 1,000 times, if you started over, in every case you'd begin with simple communal societies. That's the way hunting and gathering would get organized everywhere. There'd be variant forms, there'd be some with some kind of thin hierarchies, but they'd all be basically sharing economies based on reciprocities as their core way of socially cooperating to produce what's needed. And the story then is, if you had 1,000 Earths with our ecology, eventually agriculture is going to be discovered in particularly congenial ecologies. A capacity to increase the productivity of labor will go up. That is, how much food, how many calories of sustenance can be produced with how many hours of labor, that goes up. And suddenly the technology makes possible the production of a surplus. And then the theory is that when that happens, eventually non-capitalist class relations are going to take advantage of that surplus producing capacity. And you'll get a class of people that will grab the surplus and use that to control the labor of others. And furthermore, and this is the tricky bit, I think, which is what animates Cohen's argument, that enables the forces of production to develop further. That is, if class structures had not emerged out of that early form of agriculture, if that had not happened, if for some reason that we can't explain it never happened, the forces of production would have permanently stagnated at the level of simple agriculture. There would not have been a steady increase in the forces of production. The condition for the steady increase of the forces of production after the discovery of agriculture 4,000 or so years ago was the emergence of class structures organized within agriculture. Well, let's turn now to systematically elaborating the actual nature of the explanations. This is Roman numeral 3. The basic logic of Cohen's reconstruction, and from here on I'm going to stick to Cohen's account. There are others that are somewhat different. I think this is, again, the most systematic way of approaching this set of problems. Cohen believes that Marx's theory of this trajectory, the reason why the trajectory is not random, why there is a non-arbitrary connection between the forces and the relations of production, depends upon a particular kind of explanatory strategy, which we've looked at already in a couple of contexts, but which are called functional explanations. Functional explanations are at the core of historical materialism. Historical materialism could be thought of as a kind of dialectical functionalism. Functionalism, in that the core explanations are this type, dialectical because it's functionalism plus contradictions. A non-dialectical functionalism of the sort associated with American sociology in the 1950s treats the functional integration of society as integrative, but not contradictory. The Marxian variant of functionalism, Cohen argues, is a kind of contradictory functionalism, but nevertheless functionalist. And there are two basic functionalist explanations. The first is the forces of production functionally explain the relations of production. And second, the relations of production functionally explain the superstructures. These are two interconnected functional explanations. So, just to remind you, this is a kind of quick reprise of the previous discussions. Functional explanations are not simple. They're tricky. They're really interesting. Some people argue that they're not really explanations at all. functional explanations are always just functional descriptions, and underlying every functional explanation is just a straightforward causal explanation. You know, X causes Y. X has mechanisms which generate Y. Functional explanations, some people argue, are phony explanations. As I've said, I think functional explanations are fine. There are causal mechanisms embedded in them, but the difference between a simple causal explanation and a functional explanation is that functional explanations have interconnected loops of causal explanations, which then produce this particular kind of feedback process, so that you can explain the existence of something by the beneficial consequences that it has for the system as a whole. And the simplest examples, again, come from biology. Why do birds have hollow wings? Well, aeronautically, the engineering properties of wings are such that if the wings were not hollow, they would be too heavy. And given this, the problems of engineering flight, which are the result of the laws of physics, if you had heavy wings, birds couldn't get off the ground. In order for birds to fly, the wings must be hollow. We observe that the wings are hollow, and we ask, why are they hollow? How do we explain this? And we explain the hollowness of the bird's wings by their consequences. And then the more elaborate form is, hollow wings are beneficial for birds because they enable birds to fly. The function of hollow wings is to enable flight. Now, if birds were engineered by an engineer, which intelligent design theorists of species claim, the divine engineer, then we would say this is an intentional explanation. God realized, in order to have birds fly, that the wings had to be designed in this way. So it's true that the wings are, the bones are hollow because it has these positive effects on the flight of birds, but the explanation is the purposes of God. The explanation isn't functional. It's a functional description. The explanation isn't functional. The explanation is just intentional. It's just a particular kind of intending being. That's what creationism claims, or intelligent design views of evolution. What Darwin has shown is you don't need a creator. You don't need an intelligent purpose behind functional properties. Rather, we have a mechanism, a feedback mechanism called natural selection, which therefore makes the functional description also a functional explanation. Well, there's more and interesting philosophical issues around exactly how to pinpoint and really give precision to that kind of explanation. In the debates between Cohen and Elster on this matter, and also in the book, there are sections where he really burrows down into functional explanations and discusses what he calls dispositional facts that exist prior to the development of the functional property. This gets pretty elusive. I think it's kind of interesting. You know, I find philosophy of science stuff intriguing. I imagine some of you also like these methodological discussions. I'll give you the one sentence version, but I won't explain it. A dispositional fact is of the following form. In a world of short-necked giraffes, it is already the case in the short-necked giraffe that they have as a dispositional fact that their ability to reproduce would be enhanced by having a longer neck. So there's all sorts of facts about creatures at any given point of time, which are facts about their connection to their environment and about their morphology, you know, the kind of structures they already have, that certain kinds of changes would improve their fitness. That explains why it is that when randomly they get that attribute, it sticks. So there's this argument that the dispositional fact is prior to the functional outcome. And so that restores the normal temporality of cause and effect. the dispositional fact explains why it is the case that when the random mutation occurs, it is a mutation that sticks. Well, okay, that's just a whiff of what the argument is. And it seemed to have expended itself in the course of the 1980s. I don't see much discussion of functional explanation anymore. All right, that's the structure of functional explanation. I briefly mentioned its contrast to intentional explanation. We won't belabor that point now, and also the distinction between a functional explanation and a functional description. Functional descriptions are important because without a functional description, there'd be no point in trying to have a functional explanation. So there's nothing wrong with functional descriptions. But it's still the case, once you get the functional description, you have to make an argument for why the description actually explains the properties in question. And that's what evolutionary biology does. In social contexts, the identification of feedback mechanisms is harder. And we don't have as tight an account of the feedback processes by which the beneficial effects feed back to ensure the selection of the relevant structural property. It's a looser kind of argument. There are some specific contexts where it seems very straightforward and powerful, and they are often contexts which have a kind of Darwinian flavor to them. The simplest example is if you take capitalist firms and we ask, why do capitalist firms have these business strategies that they have? So you observe a particular strategy and you ask, why do they have that strategy? And a standard answer is, well, it's profit maximizing. And why do they maximize profits? It enables them to survive. It improves their fitness in the competitive market. The fitness of firms is pretty similar to the fitness of animals. In the case of animals, it's sexual reproduction and the passing on of genes to the next generation. In the case of firms, it's just their self-reproduction over time. That is, they disappear if they're not fit. And then new firms get formed all the time. The simple argument for the functional explanation here would have the following form. Let us suppose that business owners, when they start a firm, have a giant book of all possible business strategies, and they randomly pick one. That they use no intelligence, no purposes. They just randomly pick them. And all firms just randomly pick strategies. If you come back 10 years later and observe the population of existing firms, the ones that are left are all going to be profit-maximizing firms. They will have randomly just happened to have selected the strategies that are profit-maximizing, and those are the firms that would have continued to survive, even though no intentions explain why they pick those strategies. If you then add intentions, you're just improving the efficiency by which they get to that stage. Fewer firms will get weeded out because of the random error of picking a lousy strategy because there will be some intelligence involved. Now, that's not a bad description because a lot of businesses, when they're founded, business owners are working on hunches. They're confused. A lot of them are very badly informed. A lot of business strategies are kind of random. I mean, you know, random in the sense that teenagers say, well, that's random, you know, meaning without good intention and good purpose. There's a lot of just copying without much insight. And so there's some truth to the fact that the brutality of the feedback process of competition does weed out the bad strategies. It also provokes changes in strategies. So you can think of a slightly different functional process. You randomly pick strategies, you begin to go bankrupt, you randomly pick another. Right? So it continues to be a random process, but you only change when things go badly. That would also give you functional outcomes. And that's kind of the way business strategies work. You do an initial start value, so to speak. You pick one, you think it's a little better than random. You observe in practice how it works. you get the feedback of sales not going well, of nobody buying your products, and you scratch your head and say, well, what can I do about it? And you pick a little less random process because now you have more information. So this is a case where intentionality, the purposes of human agencies, improve the effectiveness of the functional explanation. But it's still a functional explanation because it's the real consequences of action which are feeding back to change the practices, mediated by the purposes of actors. Well, that's how I basically think we should think of functional explanation in sociology. It's almost always mediated by insight and agency. It doesn't really happen fully behind the backs of actors, the way genetic mutations and natural selection operate behind the backs of critters. It does work through human agency, but human agency is pretty flawed. It doesn't have the capacity for good, proper selection to produce functional outcomes in a sufficiently consistent way. So there's a lot of trial and error, with the feedback being the real consequences of action. All right, that's functional explanation. I've already mentioned, I think, in a previous lecture that functional explanations are not epiphenomenal. And this is just something to be in your repertoire to the extent that you find these kinds of explanations and the Marxian way of putting the pieces together in its broad shape is attractive, and somebody accuses you of saying that to provide an economic explanation of ideology is reductionist and makes ideology epiphenomenal, you can say, no, that's wrong. To functionally explain ideology by virtue of the way it stabilizes capitalism is to say it's incredibly important, not that it's epiphenomenal. Epiphenomenal means something which is a reflection or effect of something else, but which itself has no important consequences. It's just appearances. It doesn't have any substance. It doesn't really matter. Well, the things which Marxists try to explain functionally in this, even in the crude base superstructure model, which is not a model I would endorse, but which I think has a kernel of truth in it, even in the crude versions, it is never a claim about epiphenomenality. It's always a claim that that which is in the superstructure is really important. It matters, because without those practices from the state and ideology and law and other superstructural institutions, without those practices, the system would be way more unstable than it is. Superstructures explain the stability of the base. And that's also why they are there. The addition, that's why they are there, is the functional explanation. That they explain the stability of the base is what makes it not epiphenomenal. Okay, that's just reiterating. All right, now what is actually the functional explanation in historical materialism? Cohen introduces functional explanations as a way of reconciling two sets of seemingly contradictory propositions. So the way to think about it is we have these pairs of propositions which don't seem to go together. The way to reconcile them, Cohen argues, is to connect them functionally. So the first proposition is the level of development of the productive forces in a society explains the nature of its economic structure. The crude form is technology explains economic institutions. Second proposition is the economic structure of a society has the effect of furthering the development of the productive forces. So how can we both say that the productive forces explain the economy and the economy explains the forces of production? Second pair is the economic structure explains the nature of the superstructure, paired with the superstructure has the effect of contributing to the stability of the economic structure. Again, you can think of this as reconciling the economy explains the state and the state explains the economy. That is, the state explains the economy in the sense that the economy would collapse without it, the economy explains the state in the sense that without this economic structure, you wouldn't have that kind of state. How do you reconcile these? Well, what Cohen says is there's a simple but elusive link, which has to do with substituting in the left-hand proposition the word explains with functionally explains. The economic structure takes the form that it takes because, given the existing levels of the forces of production, this economic structure has the effect of furthering the development of the forces of the productive forces. That's a functional explanation of the economic structure by the forces of production. The superstructure takes the form it takes because this has the effect of contributing to the stability of the economic structure. So functional explanations are what reconciles the two-way causation implied by these pairs. Within these two-way causations, there's the claim that there's a primacy to the part of the two-way causation that has the functional explanation. So there's a primacy of the forces of production in the two-way causation of forces of production and economic structure, because that's what generates the functional connection between them. And it's the functional connection between them which generates the hook that gives you an historical sequence of economic structures given the development of the forces of production. Now what I'd like to do is focus in the rest of this lecture on the productive forces, productive relations connection. We've talked about the state and ideology, about the base superstructure issues in the earlier lectures, and we may revisit that a little bit in this discussion, but I want to mainly focus on this core economic logic, the problem of technological determinism in the general theory of history. I think it's perfectly fine to use the expression technological determinism. I mean, that's sort of an in-your-face way of talking about this, right? Because it sends shudders up people's spine. Technological determinism. It sounds like it's almost anti-human, the expression technological determinism. With proper clarification, it is an accurate way of describing what renders possible a theory of history. So the theory of history is a form of technological determinism in Marx. It is a form of technological determinism. But you have to really clarify what's meant by that, because it is not hardware determinism. It's not determinism by things at all. It's a determinism that is profoundly connected to human agency. It is only by virtue of the kind of agents we are in history, our rational, intelligent, strategic capacities, that technology is the determining process. So it's not an anti-agency view. And that's what needs to be clarified in order to understand how this really works. So here are the steps in the argument. First, the first thing, why do the productive forces tend to develop at all? How do we explain the development of the forces of production in the most general sense? Cohen argues that historical materialism begins with what could be called foundational facts about human beings and their situation in the world. So this is a foundational claim about about human nature and the human condition. This is a trans-historical claim that Cohen is making. He's saying that this is an intrinsic feature of what it means to be a human being. So it's part of our nature, and it's part of our condition. And when it is not part of our condition, if you can find instances where this description does not hold, then you will not get history. That is, you only get history that can therefore be theorized as through a theory of history if these properties hold. human beings live in a world of scarcity such that to survive, they must transform nature in various ways. That's the condition, the human condition, as we live in a world of scarcity and must transform nature in various ways in order to survive. Furthermore, we are the kinds of creatures which have the capacity to respond to this condition of scarcity. And the key aspects of our capacity are intelligence and what could be called instrumental rationality. Instrumental rationality means if we have a goal, we can figure out the means to achieve that goal. We align our means, or we adopt means to achieve goals. It's a very simple, thin notion of instrumental rationality. So we're the kind of creatures which have the capacity to respond to this condition of scarcity by improving our way to transform nature to meet our needs, if only in a slow and haphazard manner, in order to make our survival more satisfactory. The human condition is scarcity. The human capacities are intelligence and instrumental rationality. So the idea here would be you have creatures with instrumental rationality and intelligence. You put them in a context of scarcity where they have to expend effort to satisfy their needs by transforming nature. And you can add details about this, that there's risks, that it's not just that sometimes, some parts of the year, they've got enough food easily available, but their intelligence enables them to know that sometimes there are droughts, some part times of the year it's harder, that it would be nice to be able to store food. You know, they have an ability to understand things and make plans. Given that, and they have these capacities, they will try, if only in a slow and haphazard way, to improve their ability to meet their needs. If they happen to live in the Garden of Eden, so if some human beings happen to live in a particular ecology where these conditions do not hold, that is, there's superabundance of everything it takes to survive, and it takes relatively little effort and sacrifice and risk to acquire it because the bountifulness of nature is so great. That's the image of the Garden of Eden. Then they will have no incentives, no pressure to improve their ability to transform nature, even though they still have the capacity to do so. Their intelligence and instrumental rationality will not get deployed to develop the forces of production. But if they live at all in an environment of scarcity, where scarcity includes uncertainty and risk, then slowly, haphazardly, they will, when discoveries are made, improve their ability to transform nature. This does not imply an incessant preoccupation on the part of Homo sapiens to invent new things. There's no inherent drive, positive motivation for technical change, but simply a minimal claim that when technical changes occur that improve productivity, there will be a tendency for them to be adopted. And once adopted, it's unlikely to be reversed unless the knowledge behind the innovation is lost. So once fire is mastered, once a community figures out how to produce fire, rather than just take advantage of it when it occurs in the natural environment, once they discover how to harness fire, that is quickly recognized as a valuable new technology that improves the quality of life, and therefore the knowledge is taught to the next generation. And unless something happens, like the community is destroyed, that knowledge will be reproduced over time. The same with tools. even in hunting and gathering societies, there are tools. There are tools for hunting. And initially, the tools are less developed than later in the course of the Neolithic era or whatever the appropriate label is for the technological level of early hunting and gathering societies. Over time, there were improvements in the technologies of hunting, and once those improvements occur, they're passed on. What that means is the notion of them being improvements is something that is universally recognized by human beings. We have a capacity to know when we're doing something in a better way than the past, which means less risk, less effort, greater quality of the final product. You know, so there's different technologies of hunting. You can chase buffalo over cliffs. That was one way of hunting buffaloes, and they get smashed below. You can shoot them with arrows. I have no idea about the pros and cons of these two technologies for hunting buffalo, but presumably in the tribal societies in North America that were buffalo hunters, before they had horses, so before the 16th century, different strategies were used for hunting buffalo than when suddenly this new technology arrived because of horses that escaped from the Spanish. The Plains Indians were not horse-riding hunters of buffalo prior to the 17th century, or 16th century, I guess, is when the horses finally made it up to the plains. But they quickly adopted this new technology, and they weren't taught it by the Spanish. They saw these horses, and they figured out that this was a better technology for hunting buffalo, and they adopted it, even though for, you know, thousands of years they had been hunting buffaloes without horses. Well, that's this basic primordial fact, that when, even if it's by accident, a better technology is discovered or happened upon or invented by some clever person, it's easily recognized as better, where better means an improvement in the ability to transform nature. Okay, so that's the first key idea, that there is something in our very nature that explains why there's at least a weak tendency for the forces of production to develop. And this weak transhistorical tendency, the way to just think about it is that there's a temporal asymmetry between the acquisition of new capacities and the loss of capacities. So it's not that there's a massive drive to develop new capacities, but when, for whatever reason, a new capacity is achieved, it's more likely to persist than to disappear. That's all you need. You'll get a weak tendency for forces of production to develop so long as it has this ratchet equality, an asymmetry in the probability of keeping an innovation when it happens, then abandoning it or losing it or forgetting it once it happens. Then, even if you have a very low probability of acquiring new innovations, over time they will accumulate. That's the transhistorical story. That applies everywhere. That applies to, you know, peasant societies and capitalist societies and hunting and gathering societies, that particular point. In different societies, however, there is additional issues involved in the development of the productive forces. All right, so how does this dynamic work? Here's, I think, the way the kind of basic story would be told. By improving forces of production slowly and unevenly, people gradually transform their ability, their capacity to transform nature to such an extent that it eventually becomes possible for people to produce more than the pure subsistence needs of their own population. This doesn't mean that there will actually be a physical surplus, it just means that it can be produced. That a surplus production is possible because your productive capacity has increased. It's always possible that instead of producing a physical surplus, people can simply decide to work less, to have more leisure time. So this is a kind of, this is another universal, that if you have a particular standard of living with, in terms of what you consume and your ability to produce it increases, one option is to simply reduce the amount of work you do so that leisure increases. Once the forces of production have developed to the point where a surplus can be produced, it becomes possible for a class of people to arise which don't produce anything. Before you have the ability to produce a surplus, you cannot have a class of non-producing people. It's not physically possible. Everybody has to participate in production because there is no surplus to feed and house and take care of people who are not themselves producing. There's always some non-producing people, of course. Babies are non-producing people. But there's not always elderly non-producing people. There are societies in which once a person is no longer able to contribute to the to their own reproduction, they are abandoned. That's rare. I mean, usually, even in hunting and gathering, you know, even in very minimalist societies that have very low productivity, there's an ability to produce enough more than just to sustain the people who are doing the producers, the production, and their younger infants. Is usually it's one is able to produce enough more. But there are cases where that isn't the case. I don't know if this is a kind of an urban legend, but it's often said that in Eskimo, in Inuit societies, at least in pre-modern Inuit societies, when people became very aged, they were gracefully and ceremoniously abandoned. And this was the expectation. This wasn't seen as inappropriate. Yeah?
So in the explanation of why classes develop, is there also an underlying claim about human nature in the sense that they would prefer not to work if there was a surplus
and that
they're selfish in that way?
No. I'll explain how you should think about it. Okay. So then, so far the argument is just that if once you get the ability to produce a surplus, there's the potential, it's latent, to have a class of people who don't produce. What Cohen then argues is that the actual emergence of classes under these conditions is to be explained functionally. That is, classes emerge because, given the level of development of forces of production, at that point, the emergence of classes enhances the further development of the forces of production. All right, so that's the key argument. We have to flesh it out. How could this work? Given that you have the potential for a surplus, at that point, one possibility is people just gradually reduce their amount of work. They don't actually produce a surplus. At that point, if classes were to emerge, so let's state it in the conditional form, if they were to emerge at that point, this would stimulate a more rapid subsequent development of forces of production than if they don't emerge. So at this point, we haven't yet explained why they do emerge. We're just making, this is invoking this notion of a dispositional fact. We are now at a point where if they were to emerge, the forces of production would subsequently develop more quickly. The functional explanation is then that that is most fundamentally why they do emerge. That explains why they do emerge. Well, how do we elaborate that why? How do we elaborate the connection between this very abstract dispositional idea, if they would emerge, it would further develop the forces of production. How do we actually play that out to explain why they do emerge? And I think it's 6 after 11. So let's take our break, and I will give you the punchline of that part of the story as soon as we come back.